One of the most important teachings of the Buddha, found in the Pali Canon, is his teaching on the nature of the mind. When he says, the mind, bhikkhus, remember bhikkhus refers in its broader sense to all of us who are walking on the path, the mind, bhikkhus, is luminous, but it is clouded by visiting defilements. The mind is luminous. It is clouded by visiting defilements. What does this mean? What does it mean in our actual experience? When we hear a sound, you know, it's very simple. There's just the bare knowing of hearing, you know, or feel a breath, or feel a sensation. There's no problem in the bare simplicity of that knowing. The nature of the mind, the nature of consciousness, the nature of knowing, is in itself clear and unobstructed. It's open, it's empty of self. So just to give an illustration of this, I was once in a bookstore just browsing, and I saw the title of a book. It was called The Nothing That Is. And so just the title really struck me. It turns out that it's a book about the history of the number zero. And it's by Robert Kaplan, well-known mathematician. And the first lines in the book, he wrote, when you look at zero, you see nothing. When you look through it, you see the world. And when I read those lines, I thought, what a beautiful description of the nature of mind, this open, empty, clear, unobstructed, luminous nature. When you look at zero, or when you look at the mind, you see nothing. Look through it, and you see the world. I didn't get much further than those two lines, because the rest of the book was quite mathematical. But it was worth the purchase. So the question for us, both here on retreat and particularly in the busyness of our lives in the world, what is it that obstructs or clouds this basic clarity, this basic luminosity, this basic openness? Why don't we live from this place of ease, from this place of peace? When we look carefully, and that's the whole purpose of coming on retreat, is just to give us the opportunity to look at our minds, our bodies, our experiences with a greater degree of clarity and undistractedness. When we look at our minds in this way, we see that what causes suffering for ourselves and others, what causes the mind to become obscured and clouded, are the visiting defilements, what we could call the afflictive emotions, those emotions that afflict the mind or cause suffering. Fred was talking last night about the unwholesome states of mind. These are the visitors that come. And when they're present and not attended to carefully, they obscure this natural openness and ease. There are many different kinds of afflictive emotions. There's a long list, and I think most of us are familiar with many of them. There's anger, there's fear, there's anxiety, there's depression, there's envy, there's jealousy. There's pride, there's unworthiness, there's depression, there's grief, there's frustration. So it's a long list. There are many more than that. It's important to understand that it's natural that these feelings will arise. They do arise within us at different times in our lives. Our challenge is learning how to work with them, to be with them in a skillful way, in a way that transforms the afflictive emotions into freedom. The mind, bhikkhus, is luminous, but it is clouded by visiting defilements. And the Buddha then goes on to say, the second line in that couplet, the mind, bhikkhus, is luminous, it is freed from visiting defilements. So the Buddha is pointing out that there is this capacity, that there is this capability we have to free ourselves from these visitors. The important point here in this teaching, which the Buddha emphasizes, is that these afflictive emotions, you know, and there was that long list of them, they come as visitors. What the Buddha is pointing out is they are not intrinsic to the mind. They are not an inevitable characteristic of the mind. They come as visitors and they can leave as visitors. The problem is that because we haven't learned how to be with them skillfully, these visitors seem to have made themselves at home in our lives. So tonight's talk is about how to remind ourselves that they're visitors and actually to show them the door. So the first and fundamental step in learning to work skillfully with them is acknowledging and recognizing them when they arise. If we don't even know that they're there, there's no way of relating to them in a skillful way. So the first step is recognition, acknowledgement of whatever the state may be, aversion, greed, pride, envy, jealousy, unworthiness, whatever it may be. Now for each of us, and among us, there's a wide range in our ability to recognize and to acknowledge these emotions when they're present. For some people, it's very difficult. Some people do not have a developed capacity to recognize these emotions when they're present. And so very often, we're living our lives being run by these emotions, being driven by these emotions, and not even understanding that they're there. You know, they drive or determine our actions, they influence our relationships, and all the time they're underground. For other people, there may be an ability to recognize and acknowledge the different emotions that are present, but we may be completely overwhelmed by them, caught up in them, carried away by them. Our lives can be carried along in the flood tide of different emotions. So there are many ways we can train ourselves to actually recognize when they're present as a first step, and then not to be carried away by them. First, we can tune into the physical sensations of our bodies. You know, feelings of tightness, of contraction, of tension, of agitation. Now, sometimes these sensations that we feel, kind of contracting sensations, sometimes these may be the result of past reactivity. It's not actually reflecting an emotion that is currently present. And so a lot of the unpleasant sensations we feel in our practice, we could almost understand as a cleaning out or an unwinding of old tensions, of old reactivity. But if they persist, and maybe even if they're getting stronger as we're paying attention, it might be worth looking to see if there's an underlying emotion underneath these growing tensions, this growing contraction in the body. Need to be a little careful here, because I'm not suggesting that with every sensation that we feel, we try to interpret it. Oh, what does this pain in the knee mean? I'm filled with rage. No, not necessarily. You might be. But rather, if the sensations, you know, if our body is giving us some kind of signal, it's just to take a look at times. That can just be a reminder at times to check in and see if there is some underlying emotion present. You know, maybe there's a feeling of frustration about something or fear. You know, that will manifest in the body, or aversion of some kind. So the physical sensations, our bodies, can often be a mirror for what's happening in our minds. So there are many examples of this, but a frequent one for me, you know, I live in New England, in Massachusetts, out in the country, and there are a lot of narrow roads, not dissimilar from the roads here. And often I'd be caught behind a very slow driver, and there are not many places to pass. And very often I would I just feel my body getting, you know, tighter and tighter. Well, it didn't take so much skill to realize that there was a little bit of impatience in the mind, you know, a little bit of frustration in the mind. So that's just a very simple example of how our body can be showing us something. Of course, the older I get, I'm increasingly becoming one of those slow drivers. So now I feel compassion for the people behind me. We can also get a clue that there's some emotion present if we're doing something and we just feel somewhat ill at ease. You know, something doesn't quite feel right. And so we might look to see, okay, what's going on in the mind? Well, there might be a train of obsessive thinking. You know, if you find that the mind is just caught in a lot of obsessive thought, very likely there's an underlying emotion which is fueling those thoughts. So years ago, this goes back 30 years, When I first started teaching, we started IMS in 1976. And for the first 13 years, I lived right in the center. I just had a room in the center and often would have to move rooms. When I turned 40, I had enough. It was like the communal living was great until then, but I just need some space. You know, and I was really had a desire to move out from living in the center. So through some very great good fortune, one of the students and friends, very great donor, basically offered to build a house for myself and a colleague, Sharon Salzberg. So this was a great magnanimous gift. So then I obsessed for a few years in the design of the house, but finally it's built. Move in, spend the first month, I moved in, first month move in, and I did a self-retreat. I thought that would be a good way to inaugurate the house. Well, my mind started obsessing during that month of, this house is too nice. Dharma teachers shouldn't be living in such a nice house. I'm going to move out. I'm going to give the house to the staff. I'm going to go build a hut in the woods. On and on and on and on. So after this went on for quite a while, I just, what is going on here? You know, so I started looking in my mind. And I realized that there was an underlying emotion which was fueling all those thoughts. And the underlying emotion, when I looked, I didn't realize what it was for a long time. But then I looked to say, oh, it was embarrassment. It's like I was embarrassed to be living in such a nice house. When I saw that, when I recognized it and saw it clearly, I realized I had a great moment of enlightenment. I realized that I would much rather be embarrassed than move out of the house. So it was really a simple decision. But until I recognized what was there, it was fueling all this suffering. I was really caught up in it. So the power, you know, when we're caught by something in that way and it's just going on and on, that's a signal. Okay, can I look to see what's the emotion underlying it? Because often we're not recognizing it. You know, we can pay attention when we're in the middle of some action and there's some part of us that knows it's not quite right. We're doing something maybe that's a little unskillful. That's another good time, you know, another prompt for us to see, okay, what emotion is driving this action? You know, a very common example of this, which really goes to the practice of right speech. And not so much here on retreat, but out in the world. You know, how often are we involved in speech, maybe a kind of gossiping or talking about other people? That is something less than kind. You know, where it's really not skillful, but it's part of just the common habit, you know, of our casual conversation, gossiping about others. So if we do that, and if we become aware, you know, of, and are trying to practice right speech, that kind of becomes a signal for us. Well, it's, you know, I'm doing it, it doesn't feel quite right. Okay, what's driving that? Very interesting to see what the emotion is underneath that kind of action. You know, is it some kind of desire to make ourselves feel better or feel more important or whatever? You know, for each of us it may be different. So watch for those times of unease as a feedback. You know, as a, it's like a little mindfulness bell. Look to see what's underneath it. Sometimes we're not aware of the emotions, the afflictive emotions that are going on within us, because we're not seeing underneath the more obvious ones. Because very often they come in clusters, they come in groups. May not be just a single emotion. Oh, just as one example of this, but there are many. Years ago, I was teaching some retreats for lawyers and law students and judges and that profession. It was very interesting. At one of these retreats, we were having a group discussion, and one of the law students said, you know, in that profession, at least in the States, it's very, there's a lot of, the English word is litigious. I don't know if that, a lot of conflict, you know, where you're in opposition, you know, to people on the other side. And so there's often a lot of tension. and competitiveness. And this law student in the discussion said, sometimes in that situation, he feels that he has to get angry so that he doesn't feel the fear. I thought that was really interesting. You know, in his mind, feeling fear would be a weakening. You know, the weakening of his position. And so in order not to feel that, anger would arise. Of course, a much more skillful way, even in that situation, would be to realize it's possible to feel the fear and actually be accepting of that feeling and then act even though the fear is there. It doesn't require anger to act in the face of fear. In fact, it takes courage. So just looking to see underneath some common examples of what might be underneath anger. You know, that's a very obvious afflictive emotion. Usually we become aware of that quite quickly. But if it's going on, you know, if it feels like something is feeding it, we're being caught up in it, carried away by it, that would be a time to just look underneath. Very often underneath anger might be a feeling of hurt, of being hurt, you know, or frustrated, or resentment. Resentment can fuel anger. Or self-righteousness, you know, where we have that strong feeling of being right about something, and that just feeds the anger. So again, it's a it's a way of deepening our understanding, our recognition of what it is that's going on. Sometimes we have to see the underground spring for the most obvious emotion. Now, this kind of investigation, when we're looking into our hearts, looking into our minds, to really understand what's going on, it's not particularly discursive. It's not thinking about it. And it's not digging into our psychological or emotional histories. Rather, it's just raising the question in the mind, okay, what's going on underneath? And then stepping back and allowing an intuitive awareness to see what's there. So it's not so much a thinking process. It's a matter simply of quieting down a bit more, stepping back, opening up. Sometimes we can do that with a very simple question, and I've used this very often in my practice. When something's going on that I don't quite yet see clearly, I'll just kind of settle back and open up with the question, okay, what's happening? That's all. Just pose that question, what's happening here? And in that openness, the openness to that question, very often, what's actually there is revealed. And sometimes it's not. Sometimes we ask the question, what's happening? And we still don't know. And so we can make the note or the acknowledgement, confusion. Not knowing. Chaos. Right? We're just open to that level of the experience. Sometimes we don't recognize the afflictive emotions that are present because we are misperceiving them. We're taking one emotion to be another. So there are many examples of this, but one was very striking to me earlier on in my practice. When for whatever reason I was just sitting and there was a lot of sadness. And I was noting sadness, sadness, sadness. But it didn't feel like it was quite connecting, even though that's what I thought it was. So I'm noting, it's not getting clarified. So I just looked. The fact that I had that feeling of being stuck in some way, that stuck feeling is a good indication we're not seeing it clearly. So I looked more carefully and I saw that it wasn't sadness. It was unhappiness. And the two may be a little similar, but they're really quite different emotions. As soon as I could name it correctly, as soon as I saw, oh, this is unhappiness, it was like the mind became aligned with what was there. And in that alignment, I could become accepting of it. For as long as I was misperceiving it, there was not the possibility of accepting it, because I wasn't aligned with the truth of what it actually was. So when we're stuck in some way, you might just take a look and see, okay, is this recognition accurate? A few other emotions that we often confuse might confuse anger with frustration. These are two different feelings. And one of my favorite confusions to talk about, which could be a whole Dharma talk, is the confusion between love and attachment. For most people, these two feelings are completely intertwined. And for many, it's even hard to imagine loving without being attached. And yet, when we really look carefully, not only are they very different feelings, the one subverts the other. You know, when you're feeling most loving, and I suggest it be interesting for you to do this at times, you know, when you're feeling most loving, what does that feel like? You know, and when I have that experience, it's really a kind of an openness, a generosity of the heart. It's like that. When we're feeling most attached, even to those we love, but what is the feeling of attachment? It's like a holding. What's so remarkable about this, but I think there are very few people who take the time to discern the difference. But what's so remarkable is we see that attachment does not in any way enhance or grow the feeling of love. In fact, quite the opposite. You know, the more attachment there is, the more fear, the more possessiveness. It's all the things which hinder the feeling of love. So again, it's common. I mean, for almost everybody, these two are going to be interwoven. But can we take the time to investigate, to see, does that really serve us? Is this in the cause of our happiness or not? I actually didn't mean to go off on all that, but it's so seductive to me, that particular distinction. Okay, so the first step in working with afflictive emotions is clear recognition. So we actually see accurately what is present. The second step in working with afflictive emotions is the mindful acceptance of them. And this can be challenging when the emotion is unpleasant. It's afflictive. It's causing suffering. What does acceptance of these kind of emotions mean? It doesn't mean justifying them. It doesn't mean wallowing in them. It doesn't mean judging them. Rather, it's simply the full acknowledgement that this particular emotion is present. This is what's here now. So here, acceptance is really another word for mindfulness. One indication of non-acceptance, when we're feeling something an indication of non-acceptance will be the feeling of struggle. And it's very interesting on retreat because very often, a common experience at different times, we feel like we're struggling in our meditation. Struggle only means one thing. It means something is arising in our experience that we're not accepting. Because if we were accepting it, we wouldn't be struggling. So it's very simple. The problem is that usually we just get caught up in the struggle. We get identified with the struggle instead of seeing that the feeling of struggling is itself a very useful feedback. It's almost like a mindfulness bell. If we're struggling, okay, wake up, something is happening that I'm not accepting. And so then we can take a look to see what it is. You know, is it some unpleasant sensation in the body? Is it some afflictive emotion that we're not open to, that we're not accepting? Is it the fact that the mind is endlessly thinking? If we're struggling with that, it means we're not accepting of the fact that that's what's happening at that particular time. For those of you who have practiced in Asia, you know that one of the great challenges in most places is the noise. Unlike this very quiet and peaceful place. So one time I was at the monastery in Burma, and they were doing construction, and they were just banging metal on metal. They were trying to straighten these steel rebars, you know, these bars, and so clang, 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 that very harsh sound all day long, every day. My mind was not happy. You know, yeah, come to Burma to get enlightened in there. And so just a lot of distress in my mind. So there was frustration, there was anger, there was all of that. But it kept on, the emotions kept on, you know, very strong. So again, the fact that they were growing and persistent, I said, Joseph, what is going on here? You know, what's feeding all this? And when I looked carefully, I saw that it was complaining mind. My mind was just sitting there complaining about it. As soon as I could name it, that allowed me to actually become aligned with what was there, could accept the fact that there was complaining mind, and actually in noting complaining, in the moment of noting complaining, the mind isn't complaining. It's just being mindful. And so the whole situation became okay. The sound was just the sound. But until I had seen clearly and accepted what was there, I was in that place of struggle. Now, sometimes we don't accept what's there, particularly the afflictive emotions, because they're just too painful. And sometimes they're too painful because they don't fit our idea of what a good meditator should be feeling. You know, good meditators aren't greedy, and they're not hateful, and they don't lie. And so if and when these feelings come up, oh, I can't be feeling these because I'm a good meditator, and good meditators don't have these feelings. And so we're not accepting of the fact that these afflictive, meaning causing suffering, emotions, we don't accept the fact that they're present. But as long as we are unwilling to feel certain emotions, and particularly the ones that are painful, we live very defensively in our lives. It's like we're living in fear of having these emotions. And so we create all kinds of strategies to protect ourselves from feeling them. You know, in the West, how much of our culture is designed to protect us from feeling bored? I think the economy would probably collapse if people got okay with feeling bored. And that's a rather benign example, but it would be interesting just for you to take a look. Are there certain emotions, basically, that you're unwilling to feel because they're too painful? You know, just as in practice, we have to learn how to gradually open to unpleasant physical sensations and to realize it's okay. They're unpleasant, but it's okay. It's possible just to be with the unpleasantness. We can do the same thing with painful emotions. There are times, though, when we need to open to these very slowly or very gradually, because sometimes painful emotions are coming from deeply wounded place. You know, there are times when people are re-experiencing old trauma from the past or present trauma, you know, and these very intense feelings can come up that can be overpowering, that can be overwhelming. There are times when this happens. So if we're losing our balance, if we really feel that this is too much, we're getting overwhelmed by this, the skillful thing to do at that time is not to plow through, but actually to back off. We need to be tender with ourselves in that situation and realize we need to create a little more space. We move away from the intensity of it so that we can find a place of greater inner safety, a place of balance. And then again, when the mind feels a bit stronger, when it feels like it has a bit more capacity, so we approach those emotions very gently. We just touch them a bit. And in this way, we learn to be with them, but in a skillful way. And this is really important because we've seen people over the years try to go into the intensity of these too quickly, too fast, and the mind can get overwhelmed by them. So it takes a lot of discernment, you know, of what it is that's going on, what the emotions are, what our relationship to them is. Do we have the capacity to be with them? After the clear recognition and the mindful acceptance, the next step in working with afflictive emotions is something Fred talked about last night, and that is the wise discernment between seeing what are skillful emotions and what are unskillful ones. And skillful and unskillful here, or wholesome and unwholesome, simply mean what are those emotions which lead to greater peace, to greater happiness, and which emotions, when not understood, when not related to carefully, just create more suffering for ourselves and others. Now, some care is needed here as well, because it's a very small step from realizing this emotion is unskillful, like hatred or like greed. We can see it, and we're not judging it. We're just seeing it. Greed is here, and we understand this is an unskillful mind state. But it's a very simple, easy step to go from that understanding to then thinking, well, I'm unskillful, I'm unwholesome because I'm having it. And so we get involved in all kinds of self-judgment. Or that it's bad that it has arisen, therefore I'm a bad person. You know, and so we create this whole pattern of self-judgment, which is the misapplication of wise discernment. You know, wise discernment sees what's skillful and unskillful, not in order to judge ourselves, but rather in a very straightforward way to understand, oh, these mind states should be cultivated. They bring happiness. These mind states should be let go of. They bring suffering. That's all. It's not a reflection. It's not a self-judgment, you know, about who we are. Sometimes it's difficult to practice this discernment of what's skillful and unskillful, because unskillful states sometimes are very seductive, and we justify them to ourselves. And the Buddha pointed this out in one very short line, but it's so clear. He said, anger with its poisoned source and honeyed tip. You know, when we look at the source of anger, it's really rooted in ill will. But it has a honeyed tip. There's part of us which enjoys the feeling, you know, because in some way maybe it feels that it makes us feel strong or powerful or energized. And so we justify it. We're not seeing what its root is, what its source is. So this discernment of skillful and unskillful needs to be deep. It needs to be all-encompassing. This discernment is particularly important. Understanding what are wholesome states of mind, what are unwholesome. Because it's not just about our own happiness or suffering. These are the states that we are acting out in the world. You know, when we look at what's going on in the world and just we hold the question, ask the question, why is there so much avoidable suffering in the world? You know, why is there so much hunger? In the world, there is enough food. It's just not distributed very well. You know, why is there war? Why is there social injustice? Why is there racism? You know, all the kinds of suffering that could be avoided, it's there because people are acting out these unwholesome mind states that are within all of us. It's the acting out of greed, the acting out of hatred, the acting out of fear. So these things are not just in people out there. They're within ourselves as well. So we have a responsibility, not only to ourselves. We really have a responsibility to the world to train ourselves, you know, to see our own minds more clearly. So we can see what's arising and make wiser choices and have our actions come from a place that is wholesome, from a place that is skillful. Okay, so there's clear recognition. There's acceptance of what is arising. There's discerning what is wholesome, what is unwholesome. The last step in working with afflictive emotions is perhaps the most challenging and the most difficult. And that is learning to open to them and to feel them, but without becoming identified with them, without taking them to be self. Now, what does identification with an emotion mean? How do we experience that? It means, or it's the experience of being caught up in it, of being carried away by it, of taking the emotion to be self. This is me. This is who I am. So you might really pay attention to the difference in your experience when you're feeling, I'm sad, I'm happy, I'm angry, which is the usual way we relate to emotions. How are you feeling? Oh, I feel happy today. I'm sad. Notice the difference between that and the mindful awareness. There is sadness. There is happiness. There is anger. Those two experiences from the inside are very different. The first, when there's identification with the emotion, if you are really looking and investigating, I think you'll feel that there's a certain quality of contraction, of narrowness. It's as if we're caught up in it. When there's mindful awareness of the emotion without the identification, and check this out, really look to see in your own experience, mine has been that there's a much greater sense of openness. It's not that contraction. Openness, greater ease. We begin to see that all of these emotions are arising out of different conditions. They are visitors. They're not I, they're not self, they're not who we are. Rather, in this open, empty, luminous nature of the mind, conditions come together and emotion arises, just like conditions come together and clouds form, cloud formations. Conditions change, the clouds dissolve. We can see how emotions are arising within us in exactly the same way. So how can we really explore this conditionality? So it's not just theoretical, but we're actually seeing in our own experience how conditioned emotions are. So one very interesting investigation, this is something that continually fascinates me, is to see the relationship between thought and emotion. And it goes both ways, how thoughts condition emotions and how emotions condition thought. Certain thought arises. Well, I'll just give you an example. So this is some years ago, although different situations like this happen all the time, but going through, you know, some difficult time at IMS, and I don't remember what the situation was now, but somebody was doing something, you know, and so a lot of anger arose. That I thought it was something harmful, and then weeks later, the situation had long gone. Weeks later, I was on retreat. I just had to think about it. I just had to have the thought of that person or the situation. Thought comes, all that anger is right there. I was so astounded by this. The situation was not happening. Thought, emotion. I don't know, it's kind of crazy. But just to see it, you know, what is happening in the mind that a thought, which is essentially little more than nothing, has the power to trigger an emotion which can be so powerful and overwhelming. Well, you know, you might think of something or maybe anticipate something in the future. You have a thought, fear arises. Just coming from the thought, but to see how conditioned it is. So sometimes I would just play. I would purposely have these thoughts just to trigger the emotion, just to see that happen again and again, because it was a reminder, yeah, this emotion is just coming out of a condition. We can see the conditionality of emotion when we see that what we're feeling very much depends on our level of understanding. So what may be very disturbing to one person may leave another person quite at ease. So my favorite story of this, you're probably familiar with it because it's kind of a classic story, of Ryokan, the Zen master poet of 18th century. He was this hermit, lived up in the mountains, and very lovable, but he lived by himself, you know, and just be wandering the mountain villages and playing with the village kids. Very poor, had almost nothing. So one day he came back to his little hut, and he saw that his few possessions that he had been stolen. So Ryokan is also a great haiku poet. So he came back to his hut, everything is stolen. What does he do? He composes a haiku. The moon at the window, the thief left it behind. Okay, so you leave the retreat, you go back to your home, everything is stolen. The moon at the window, the thief, I don't think so. Different levels of understanding will condition different emotions. So they're not fixed. You know, and we can begin to see that they're not so solid. One very helpful way of dealing with afflictive emotions, in addition to, you know, all of the things I've mentioned, of clear recognition and acceptance and discernment of what's skillful and unskillful, of seeing how conditioned they are by our thoughts, by our levels of understanding. Another part of practice that can be very helpful when we're caught, you know, in some storm of emotion is to activate what I call the inner Dharma coach, you know, where we're actually coaching ourselves. There's one teaching, you know, the Dalai Lama uses very often, which I think comes from Shantideva, where he says, you know, we should respect and honor our enemies, or difficult people in our lives, because they teach us patience. Now, that's a powerful teaching and practice, but how many of us actually remember to do that, to apply that in moments of conflict? You know, when we're in a difficult situation, do we bow and say, thank you for teaching me patience? Probably not, because we don't remember. We don't remember. This is an opportunity that actually can help develop us. Sometimes just reflecting, you know, when we're caught up in some inner struggle, just this inner Dharma coach, is this really of such overwhelming importance? Given the magnitude of suffering in the world. You know, we can get so caught up in our own stories, in our own dramas. And yet, if we just take a moment to reflect on the world outside of ourselves, you know, and the level of suffering that exists in the world, it can really help to put things in perspective and ease that contraction. Remembering and reflecting on the impermanence of all these states. So this can actually be a reflection that whatever the afflictive emotion is, you know, and there was that long list, whenever we get caught, remembering, calling to mind, reflecting on the fact, this is just another impermanent state. And the Buddha, I mean, he spoke about this often, but this one particular teaching is very precise. He said, so indeed, these states, really any state, but here particularly the afflictive emotions, these states not having been come into being. Having been, they vanish. Regarding these states, abide unattracted, unrepelled, independent, non-attached, free, not identified with a mind free of barriers. It's a very direct teaching. It's just recollecting whatever the intensity of the emotion might be, the intensity of the afflictive emotion, not having been, they come into being. Having been, they vanish. Can we remain unattached, unrepelled? Just abide in that openness. The mind is luminous. It's clouded by visiting defilements. These emotions are all visitors. It's important not to confuse non-identification with not feeling. I'm not suggesting that we don't feel these. Non-identification doesn't mean withdrawal from, it doesn't mean not feeling them, it doesn't mean denying them, it doesn't mean suppressing them. It means being totally open to the feeling of them with a mindful acceptance, but without getting caught in that identification with them as being I, as being mine, as being who I am. So it's possible to practice using these very emotions which are afflictive, which cause suffering, of actually using them in our practice to come to a place of freedom. But we have to understand how to be with them, how to relate to them with skill, with wisdom. So I just want to close with it's a line from the Persian poet Hafez. He said, "Ever since happiness heard your name, it has been running through the streets trying to find you." I think that's a nice way to think of our practice. Happiness is just running through these halls trying to find us. Can we understand ourselves so that it finally reaches us? Let's just sit for a few moments.